This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. My guest is Joan Baez, who has a collection of poetry and prose, When You See My Mother, Ask Her to Dance. Joan Baez is an internationally renowned singer, songwriter, and activist who burst on the folk music scene as a teenager in the late 1950s. She has two autobiographies, Daybreak, along with And a Voice to Sing With. There are over 30 albums, including her now classic Diamonds and Rust from 1975. She has appeared in numerous documentaries about music and activism, won the 2007 Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys, and is the subject of a recent documentary, Joan Baez, I Am a Noise, which is on Hulu and can be rented on several apps. Joan Baez will be appearing at the Bay Area Book Festival on Saturday, June 1st at 5:30 p.m. at Freight and Salvage in Berkeley. For more information, you can go to baybookfest.org. I spoke with Joan Baez via Zencastr on April 24th, 2024. What's happening now on college campuses is pretty intense. The protests about Gaza. I'd like to hear what you think about what's going on now and how that relates back to the days of the Vietnam War protests.
It's revitalizing to see the college campus involve itself in something other than people's studies, which is the same as it was, quote, back then. I wish I could be an outside agitator because I think they're on the right track and I would want to be there. It's not so much about divestment, but for me, it's about starving babies. And divestment obviously is a part of it. And actually, it is because it brings attention to something many of the population do not want to think about because it's just too awful. And or you're afraid to say something because you look like an anti-Semite. And so at least these kids have found a way to express themselves about the issue and educate us about the issue.
I mean, what scares me is that we have an out-of-control foreign prime minister in it for his own interests that could turn this country, could turn America fascist in the fall by virtue of what he's doing now. And that scares the crap out of me.
Well, it should. I think the chances of us not becoming a fascist state are pretty slim. I remember in the Bush days, I thought, oh my God, we're right on the brink. We're 2 feet from martial law. That was back then, you know, with a guy who was an sociopath. So yeah, I think it's the decade of the bully. And that's what's so difficult for us, because you and I and sane people are fighting uphill in an avalanche and trying to remain decent, trying to spread our decency to other people and other places. And we are battling like Sisyphus to do that.
I also think in terms of other issues like climate change is another one. The issue of women's rights, abortion in particular, are all kind of coming together now, and the entire world seems to be kind of falling apart. And I know it's always been.
No, it hasn't. I mean, people say that. Is this any worse than the 60s? This is far beyond anything anybody could have imagined, written about, done plays about, anything. It is, we couldn't have, I couldn't have imagined. And I know each country thinks, oh, that could never happen here. Oh, that could never happen here to our great nation. Right. Well, it's happening. So that's to deal with. I have a black joke that I made up, which is just, hopefully climate change will kill us off so Trump won't have time to make death camps. You know, we have a great future to look forward to. It's just fucking awful. What do you find to do? Well, the kids found something to do that's real. I remember back in the day making demands and having them sometimes partially met. And that's a big victory. You know, and the intelligence of groups who get together and fight for something compromises your friend, you know, that you have to do compromise or you're going to ruin your own movement. So, you know, if they learn that and are willing to, you know, play ball, but hang on to what's really important. I guess Gandhi said it's okay to compromise as long as you don't compromise your soul.
Which is a very good way to put it. Joan Baez, we'll talk a little more about all of that in a minute, but I do want to get to your book, When You See My Mother, Ask Her to Dance, which is primarily a collection of poetry. But you said in, I think, the intro that most of these poems were from the 90s. Is that correct?
They're all from about 91 to about 97 or 8. And it was a time I was doing recovery work from very drastic childhood trauma, which included sexual abuse, of course. And what happened was I was diagnosed with multiple personalities, and I've lived with these folks, you know, and back then it was discovering one after another. And there were different levels of multiple, and some people I knew had six people they knew really well, and they worked around that. I had SCADs, which is so typical of me to overdo it, you know? Really, really, it is so typical. And some of those people did the writing, and I can't write like that anymore. They wrote, and sometimes I'd look at the page, I think, oh, wow. I had no awareness of writing it. So that's where these poems are coming from.
Did you have blackouts then? I mean, these other people were coming through or something?
I had, there are a couple kinds of MPD also. One is co-consciousness, meaning I had a bird's eye view of what was going on. Some people don't have that. So they end up in somebody's, you know, pansy patch and they don't know how they got there. And I had a couple of incidents, but nothing like, you know, person with MPD who really blacks out.
Back in the day when you were a superstar, I mean, you're still a superstar, but you were, you know, you were like, God, Joan Baez, you know. Back in those days, were you having these personalities coming through and you would be sitting in the back of your head watching? Did it feel like that then?
No, I had no idea. See, that's a tricky part about any trauma and any people working through trauma, that very often is completely buried. It's completely buried from the inset, from the beginning, from the onset, because it's too awful to deal with. So you bury it. And I remember the first time incest became a topic of conversation instead of something you didn't talk about. I think it was Miss America came out and said her father had, you know, raped her. Well, wow, that was huge. She said that and risked everything, her reputation, to just say that. She remembered, but many, many, many people do not remember what happened. I certainly had no idea. It's just, you know, I knew I had phobias, I had erratic behavior, all sorts of symptoms, but I didn't understand. I didn't understand what was wrong until I decided to just, you know, crack it, go in there. And I did every kind of therapy you can do, you know, art, dance, smashing stuff, anything to get it out of there.
What about when you were actually on stage singing? Was that all you?
That's a wonderful question. You mean, was that all of us?
Or all? Well, you know what I mean. I mean, what was going on then?
Whether it was before I knew all this or after. Before, I had all the way through, my singing was consistently, and pardon me for saying this, but impeccable. You know,
right?
It was this kid who had this voice, and the kid, you know, had a lot of psychological problems, but never understood why. Until at 50, this person decided to figure it out and understood enough that I would have to do some very, very, very deep therapy, which I was willing to do. So during that time period, there was a lot of art that came out and there was a lot of poetry. I mean, it was all over the house. It still is, you know, in bits and pieces. And I, you know, we went to the storage unit and I asked my assistant to go, you know, like sell or anything to keep it coming. And there's still more.
When I was reading the book and watching the documentary, Joan Baez, I Am a Noise, which I watched the other night, I kept comparing what you were doing, because as you know, and which, you know, kind of gets me, as you know, I've been doing these interviews for many decades and talking to a lot of writers. I run across writers very early on, Stephen King, but much later, Joyce Carol Oates, who kind of talked about their writing as a kind of channeling coming up from inside. And I kept thinking, what's the difference between that and what I'm seeing in this poetry book?
Nothing. It was coming up from nothing.
It strikes me that the creative impulse is there and on some level contributes to your creativity.
Oh, it does. And you know the thing about you have to be suffering to create? You know, I was terrified because I was getting better and better. I was feeling like a grown-up human being. I remember saying to my therapist, well, what about if I get too healthy, I won't be able to write poetry and paint. And he said, well, why don't you be the first to get and go on? And that's what happened, you know.
What about when you were writing songs? Was that the same process? Was that a different process for you?
Gosh, I don't know. I think it was different. I don't know why I think that, but I think it was more me, the Joan, recording the history that I knew and the world that I knew, and not shrouded in anything dark and weird.
Dark and weird, but yes, you know, we're all dark and weird.
Yeah, well, some more than others.
You know, it's, I keep looking, particularly watching that documentary, what it must have been like for you to go from being an insecure teenager with a great voice into suddenly being a superstar on the cover of Time magazine. I mean, do you remember those feelings today? And can you put them in a context?
Yeah, I guess I sort of remember. I don't spend much time thinking about it. I do listen to the music from then because I love it. You know, what was coming out of this child was, and I can talk freely like that because it's not my doing. It was a gift. And I figure my job is maintenance and delivery. And that's kind of what I've done. But yeah, it was, I remember being, having a terrible stage fright, because I mean, how confusing for an 18-year-old to suddenly be doing this. But I took it for granted that that's what I would do, and I did.
There are images of you standing at, like, I don't know if you were actually there, Carnegie Hall or places like that, and what happens at the end when everybody applauds. Now, as somebody who occasionally has been in front of audiences, it kind of freaks me out.
It would freak me out if they didn't.
And Woodstock, you were there and I was watching you from a distance.
Yeah.
How did that feel when you first walked out on stage there? I mean, it was raining, I remember.
Yeah. You know, I don't remember, but I think that by then I'd been so long hanging out, waiting. I was in Joe Cocker's little wagon, whatever you call it, all sorts of interesting, fun stuff happened. I was pregnant, 6 months pregnant. Somebody stuck their head in the room. They said, is everything okay here? We all said, yeah. You sure? Yeah. Somebody had announced somebody was having a baby. He thought maybe it was me. I mean, the place was lunacy. So I think in all of that, I wasn't overly anxious.
In the documentary, there's a trip that you and Bob Dylan, and I know more about your relationship with Bob Dylan from that documentary. Yeah. But when you were over there, I guess that's when you became aware that as a woman, you were kind of outside of the mix.
Yeah, it was definitely as a woman. It was also as somebody who didn't do those drugs. I mean, my little Quaalude affair came way, way later. So all the stuff everybody was doing, the in crowd, was back about, that was 1964, I think. And I was complete square. I mean, I thought it was because I was better than everybody. It was because I was scared shitless, you know. And so I wasn't in that. You know, I didn't go in that room and hang out. And I don't know what would happen if I had. They would all pretend everything was okay, but I wasn't. I just didn't hang out there.
Did you have any sense when you were meeting the Beatles beyond they were just four musicians hanging out in the same room?
You know, it's different with different. The Beatles were so adorable, so funny, that it was just. I knew that was a treat. I mean, I was under the stage in Red Rocks in Colorado, huge amphitheater. It was their first concert in the States. And I was down there with all the press. I mean, I don't know how many press, each one wanting a special moment with the Beatles. And somebody came and said, "Oh, Miss Baez, they'd like to meet you." Well, I nearly dropped my teeth. And I went to their little dressing room, and one of them opened the door and said, "Hello, I'm John. And hello, I'm Ringo." And I said, "Listen, guys, you're on the cover of every magazine, newspaper in the world. I know who you are." But it was a very big deal, you know, it was a very big deal.
It started your relationship with Dylan. You were the star. And when it ended, you were still a star, but he was Bob Dylan.
He was huge, yeah. And in a way, it's still that way. He has his own stratosphere, and he doesn't ever have to come out, has never say anything to anybody. It's just an extraordinary phenomenon. He takes artist liberties with everything, but he, you know, the stuff he turned out earned artist liberties, in my opinion.
Well, it still astonishes me that this man created songs like Blowin' in the Wind. I mean, just remarkable. And the other thing about Dylan is that despite the specificity of those early albums politically, they're all just as relevant now as they were then, which is even more astonishing.
It is. And what's even more astonishing is that they're not necessarily political. You know, Only a Pawn in the Game. People use that as protest songs. It's about white people. It's excusing white people. People never put it together because you figure, oh, it's a Dylan song, only a pawn in their game. They never listen to the words. It's about the guy who shot Medgar Evers, and it's kind of saying he's just a pawn in the game. So it's an excuse for him. It's also my theory about it's not the content of the song. It's the context in which you put it. My ex loved country and Western music. And I could pick anything, the green grass of home, anything, Okie from Muskogee, and say, this song is my husband's favorite song. He's in jail for X. So it becomes your, you know, the way you say something has nothing to do with politics.
When you're singing the political songs, you talked about how you had this gift. And yet at the same time, a lot of people have gifts, but your gift, there was more to it than that, I think. It wasn't just your voice, it's communication as well. And that, to me, is what made Joan Baez, Joan Baez. The voice was great, but there was more to it.
I hope so. I made it a lifelong project to knock down the barriers between me and the audience. Because you're just thought of, people don't know you at all. And so the best I can do is try to, you know, invite the first three rows of kids in Catalonia up to the front and make real contact with them. And I did that consistently, you know, all through the years, trying to make it just us.
There are images of the Pettus Bridge in the documentary. You were down there at the Pettus Bridge?
I was at the receiving end. I was in Montgomery. I'm not sure who was there with me, but it was to receive the people as they came in. That's where I'd been invited, was to Montgomery. Yeah.
What was it like hanging out is a weird word, with Martin Luther King?
He was funny. He was very funny, and nobody will ever know that because he couldn't afford to wisecrack when he was in the pulpit. He had too much on his shoulders and too much to lose. So all they saw was this marvelous preaching. But I'll tell you, one time when I picked up King at the airport, I was so excited. I was with Andy Young and Jesse Jackson. We're going to pick up Dr. King. And they were planning a march for 2 days later. So we're going to get King. We're going to plan this march. We pick up King at the airport. And they told jokes from the airport, the N-word jokes as well, all the way to his favorite restaurant where he had, fried chicken and okra and all this stuff, got back to the conference. And they just had joked the whole way. Nobody said one serious word. And I said to Andy Young, "Andy, I thought you guys are going to plan a march." He said, "We did."
That's great. One thing about the documentary that kind of annoyed me was that it took us to Diamonds and Rust and then 2018. And it felt as if something like 30 years were missing from the documentary. And yet, when I looked on Wikipedia, what I saw was that your activism was always there, no matter what kind of therapy you were in.
Yeah.
How were you able to juggle the activism and what you were internally going through? Do you remember?
I think probably the activism helped me. It defined my day. I was afraid, but I was not too afraid to go out and do what I did. So that was clear to me. And maybe that gave me some kind of structure. And plus, everybody around me doing such, they put themselves in such danger that I sort of didn't even feel I even qualified. I mean, I was scared and nervous, but my God, what other people were doing. And I think you're right about the film. It missed a big chunk of my life.
Joan Baez, there's a point where you were arrested, though. I mean, you were willing to put your body on the line. There was that.
As opposed to what? What are you saying?
Well, I guess as opposed to the people who marched over the Pettus Bridge, it seems to me that at the time you might have thought, well, you were just kind of at the receiving end, but you were there.
Oh, yeah. I showed up at all this. I showed up whether I was scared or not. I knew that it was useful for me to be there, and it called me, and I went.
Your book also kind of hints around, but the documentary goes into more depth, the notion of memories of abuse that were never there while you were living your life and came up later. How do you view that now? Because we're 6 years after the documentary. Have you figured out, are they all real? Are they not real? Do you not care at this point?
Well, first thing comes to my mind, I'm really glad that my mother and father had a say in the film, because that's only fair. And I'm glad the family, I couldn't have done the film if the family was alive, any one of them. Well, it's also phantasmagoric that I have 50 people in here instead of just me, that I've created what I've created, written those things, which, as I say, I can't write anymore like that. And that it changed my life. I mean, that I, when I all was said and done, I was a different person. I remember a therapist once saying, oh, well, basically people never really change. I thought, you know what? I did. I mean, I feel like a whole person now, not a bunch of shards. And also, since the film was out, I would not have, like that thing in Istanbul where the curtains are going and I'm feeling like really off, this sort of a low-key panic attack. I don't have that anymore. I wish it weren't in the film. But on the other hand, it was still there 5 years ago, once in a great while. And that doesn't happen anymore.
The film also didn't talk about your painting, but you've been doing a lot of painting. Do you think that the creative impulse painting is the same as the poetry and the singing?
Yep, I do. Because they're untrained and they happen all of a sudden. Ooh, gallery. Ooh, look at all that paintings. I think I'll do that. You know, and I went to a local artist, you know, unknown, very sweet. And I said, get me started. Anything. So start off finger painting. You know, I said, just smush it on a canvas and get me started. And that's how it started. And that's my approach to it. In my 30s, and my voice was not doing everything I wanted it to do. And somebody said, why don't you get some coaching? I thought, me? Miss Natural Talent? Ha! And I needed it. And I was coached ever since. So that was many, many years ago. And I would not have been able to sing all of that time.
A few years ago, before she died, I talked to Barbara Cook, who had that voice well into her 80s, which was remarkable. At what point do you think for you that you had to deal with the transition of your own voice?
Years and years and years. There's another turn now because I battled because I couldn't make the range. I didn't have the range. And when I started singing, that's what I was known for, was that soprano. So that vanished and I started coming down. And it took until a few years ago to realize that I liked what I have, which has nothing to do with what I had. And it's just a sort of a gravelly thing. And I have a short range, but I've sort of been enjoying playing with it a little bit.
In the documentary, they had little pieces of you singing from the tour. And there were times when I'm going, she has it now. And then there were times where it's
shaky.
It's shaky. But on the other hand, after all these years, you have your style and you have your approach, and that never goes away, whether the voice does or not.
Well, I wish that were really true. It is about a total transition. And at some point, at some point I'm going to croak. Between now and then, the voice is going to do what it's going to do. You know, I have, 15 years left, something like that. What am I going to do musically during that time? Or should I just stick to poetry?
Are you still involved with the Innocence Project?
Oh, yeah. Not deeply involved, but certainly is one of the organizations I always, support financially and however I can.
How did you get involved with prison reform?
You know, now that you ask that, my mom belonged to a group called Friends Outside. This is decades ago, and it was what we still need, which is a place to go when you leave prison to get, acclimated to what the outside is. So that was early prison reform. And then my background as a Quaker, we always ended up in the anti-death penalty and being at the jail, at the prison, to protest or pray or whatever was appropriate.
And you performed at Teatro Zinzani in San Francisco for a while. How was that for you?
Madame Zinzani was a French aristocrat, and I had a blonde wig, and I was so happy just horsing around and playing magicians and trapeze artists, and I was the maitre d'âme.
And finally, I guess I have two quick questions. What's for the future of Joan Baez is first? And the second, since this is going out on the radio and in syndication, do you have any words for those people protesting about Gaza today?
Yeah, make good trouble. Whether anybody else is doing it or not, just stick to what you're doing and make good trouble.
And the other question, of course, is Joan Baez. What are you doing now?
I am about to do a whole lot of publicity for a poetry book. And on a day when I don't have a project, I have this beautiful home and things like, we finally got a frog. We made a whole pond and we never got a frog to that pond. There's too much construction going on. So put the pond in another place. And 2 days ago, we got this little guy croaking out there. That's what brings me joy.
Joan Baez will be appearing at the Bay Area Book Festival on Saturday, June 1st at 5:30 p.m. at Freight and Salvage in Berkeley. For more information, you can go to baybookfest.org. You've been listening to an interview with the legendary singer and songwriter Joan Baez, recorded during her online tour for her poetry collection, When You See My Mother, Ask Her to Dance, recorded April 24th, 2024. A documentary on her life, Joan Baez, I Am a Noise, can be seen on Hulu and rented on other streaming apps. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.